I'm Jane Reiki, and this is the second in a series on children with disabilities, kind of subtitled, What's to be Done? And our session today, we're going to discuss the general topic of families and what happens to families when a child with a handicap is born into the family or adopted into the family or becomes a part of the family, kind of what support systems are needed and what's available. And we have almost pretty largely a different group from yesterday, so I'm wondering how any of those of you who were here, who were with us yesterday, have any comments to make, any questions that are still sort of hanging there from yesterday you want to bring up?
I'm wondering, are the charts available for the development?
I have brought just a couple with me. I'd be happy to get them Xeroxed. Maybe I had a good idea to Xerox some and put them together.
Could be really
and make
helpful
them available.
To have them.
Okay, I will see what I can do here for us. If any of you wish some, let me know. We don't want to Xerox more than we need because papers are very
precious.
Are you
going to show that at all today?
Hadn't planned to. I have them with me. But
I thought if they weren't here, they might like to know what I'm talking about.
Yesterday I presented a developmental chart which shows some of the developmental stages and the sequences through which children go in a variety of areas, which gives us some indications of when children are at risk or falling behind and gives us some ideas about things we can do. So perhaps we can make that available. I'll bring them and show them other times. We're going to even start today with before that time. Yesterday was a time to understand children. And we mentioned yesterday briefly that children with disabilities or children with special needs, call them what you will, come in many degrees of neediness, in many sizes and shapes, as it were, and at different times in a child's life. So there are some kinds of disabilities, which we call developmental disabilities. If you hear that term, you'll want to know what that means. That means the child was born with the problem or develops it during childhood. Usually by the time a child is 4 or 5 or 6, a child with disabilities, the disability will be apparent. That the child is going to need some special education or some special intervention of some kind. And then there are, of course, those kinds of things that occur as a result of trauma or accident, and those are not called developmental disabilities. Those are accidental sort of trauma incidences. And I invite you as we talk about these things today, talk about the pain that families have, some of the kinds of things that are happening in families with certain kinds of children in the families, invite you to think about people you know, or you may know, or somebody you may hear about, and how you can be helpful or understanding in those situations. I think there's scarcely a community or a congregation today that does not know someone or have some experience with a child with a disability in that congregation or in neighborhood or community. They may not be as visible in some communities as others, but they are in every community. So we will all have contact with families who have special needs and children with special needs. Today I want to talk about the families. Tomorrow we want to talk about the children. Let's talk a little bit about what kinds of disabilities we might consider and what it means to families to start with. We mentioned a few yesterday. We'll start with something that is traumatic with the parents at the beginning, but in the scale and the continuum of severe to less severe, very much on the less severe side. And that's something that we yesterday called cleft palate or cleft lip. When a parent looks at a newborn child and there's this opening between the lip or a cleft in the palate so the child cannot nurse, that's traumatic. It's visually traumatic. But the doctor comes quickly and says, that's all right, we'll have surgery in a week or in a month, and things will be put together and you don't have to worry about it. And by and large, he's right. Surgery will be done very soon. Probably if the child will be baptized after the surgery, people in the congregation will not know. Except that they hear. The nursing will proceed all right. The milk no longer going through the nose, but down the stomach. The frequent feedings and the long time feeding soon disappear. And that's one of those things, a little bit of speech therapy maybe for a year or two, doesn't take very much time. Not much concern about that. Doctors are very reassuring, and rightfully so. In our country, surgery is available. In countries where surgery is not available, it's emotional and traumatic for the child and the parents forever. We find children covering their faces, not going out in public, that sort of thing, which is, but that's not true in our country. Then there are other kinds of birth traumas, traumatic for parents. Child is born with Down syndrome, it's apparent at birth. In my experience, that doctors are not very good about this. They don't really talk very much to parents. They're not very comforting. They can't fix it. And therefore, it's one of those things that they don't do very well. It's visible at birth. It's not going to go away. It's going to result in health problems for a long time. Heart, respiratory problems probably, or ear problems will plague that family. They'll have medical problems for a long time. There will be some type of retardation, severe or less severe, but the child will be in special education programs. There will be concerns about these children when they reach adolescence. There are concerns that go on forever. And where is their help? There is grief for a long time. But because the doctors are not very good at this, the ability to get some kind of support and some kind of help is very difficult. And it's a place where families are groping for some kind of, that they're going to have needs. The need that people can offer them is not short term. It's a long term grieving process for parents and grandparents and families. And even though some parents elect plastic surgery to make the child less visibly child with Down syndrome, still there are the formations of the hands and the gait that are very symptomatic and that cannot be avoided. So the fact that cosmetic surgery is frequently or sometimes done says the parents are concerned about how people talk. So that's the other side of it. Not only what's going to happen with your interaction with that child and how you work with that child, but what the neighbors and friends and other people are going to think. So that's a long term. And that goes on. I think we need to recognize that that's a long term thing. Spina bifida is one of those things when the doctor talks about that, they're more comfortable talking about that. They'll do some surgical kinds of things, but you have a child that's not going to walk. That's going to require care, that will have no control over bowels, that's going to be in a wheelchair, maybe a walker for the rest of that child's life. And so parents at birth have not only this trauma now, this pain now to think about, but they have different kinds of long-term plans to make. How do you go on vacations? Where do you go? What kind of care can you get? All of those kinds of things that go with take a wheelchair or a walker every place you go. And then I had to see some ramps here. Those are the kinds of things that face those kinds of parents, a little bit different from the others. If a child is born with the stigmata, the facial characteristics of fetal alcohol syndrome, there is the whole guilt trip. And there are guilt in other kinds of disabilities too, would say, oh yes, I had an aunt who had this, I should have known, or I had somebody in the family with this, I should have been prepared, or I should have had genetic counseling, or some of those kinds of things. A number of years ago, there was a rubella syndrome, a rubella epidemic that went through the country. People hadn't been inoculated against measles. You know, the measles are coming back. People are not taking care of the inoculations. Measles are coming back. And women in childbearing years were having children. They knew they hadn't been inoculated. They knew that there was an epidemic. They still became pregnant. And we have a bulge of deaf children in that era, in the early 60s. Children with heart problems, vision problems, deafness, depending on when in the occurrence of pregnancy, when during those first months the woman contracted measles, and there are very few of those families intact today. We've done some longitudinal studies on that. They're divorcing not only the care of the children, but the guilt trips in which both parents shared just fracture those families. So there is not only the guilt, but also the stress on families, which tears families apart. And I use that just as an example. I've worked in the school for handicapped children, and my husband is frequently asked me, how many intact families are there? There are very few. Very few. The stress is so great. Of course, the kinds of children we get are the kinds of sort of the bottom of the barrel kids, because that's the sort of school it is. But by the time we get the children, the families are no longer functioning with two parents, very few of them. We have a lot of supportive grandparents, so you get that support system drawn in. But I merely mentioned this to give you some concept of the kind of stress that families are going through, and the kind of, so you know, so that you might somehow be helpful. And I think we need to recognize that, and while I'm talking about the grieving, anger, whatever it may be, that the birth is not the only time when there is a very heavy grief work, as we say, to be done. It occurs again when the child is of an age when children start to school. And all the other kids in the neighborhood who are 5 or 6 go off to kindergarten, and this child does not go with the children in the neighborhood, or needs a special kind of schooling. And not only is it the fact that this child is different, but there is an expectation within us of, when my child is this, he will do this. And again, all of a sudden, you're faced with, that's not going to happen. And there is another grieving time. So I mentioned these kinds of things. If you are a support in your community, in your congregation, for families in grief, just when you think things are getting along pretty well, there's going to come a time when it hits you again. The next time is when a child enters adolescence, begins to have the changes of puberty. And you look at, other children, and this children is interacting with different children perhaps. You have to be concerned about their judgment, all kinds of other factors that you begin to think, what's going to happen? Is this child going to be married? Am I going to be a grandparent? All those kinds of things come fresh into a family's mind when these changes occur in children. Then there's a time when the school system no longer provides for the child. When the child is 21, they are no longer, public school is no longer available for them. And then that's another grieving time. Not what? Am I going to have to give up my vacation, my retirement time, to care for this child the rest of my life? This child is not going to make a full living, or is going to be in a group home, or can this child be independent? And if people haven't thought about that, by the time the child is 6, 7, or 8, all of a sudden, 16, 18, 19, we begin to have another sort of grief revisited, as the expectations that we have for the passages of time or the stages in children's development do not come true or do not come to fruition for certain kinds of children in our society. And I want us to think about the families and what this means to families who are in these positions. The other kinds of disabilities that emerge a bit later, which have different kinds of stress on families. Cerebral palsy, for example, is not always or often evident at birth. It becomes evident as the child's muscle system does not develop the way other children's muscles, and they don't relax, or they are this too much. And then comes the visit to the doctor, and depending upon the severity, the trips to the therapist week after week. You're working at home with the muscles. The fact that no matter what you do, you're keeping it from tightening up. It's always going to be there. It's not going to go away. And the lack of communication skills, the difficulty with talking, the drooling, which is hard to see, makes you know, keeps the child in a sort of an infant feeding stage, even though they intellectually are better. And one of those sad quirks of nature that frequently the children, matter of fact, most of the time, the children whose bodies are most severely affected are the brightest minds. We have a young man who graduated from PLU last year who was found at the age of 18 in the kindergarten. Brilliant young man. Completely devastated because he was locked in the kind of body and needed the kind of care that young children need. So there are those kinds of things through which families go in the constant ongoing stress of care and the lack of communication with those kids. So that's a different kind of problem. And frequently, we as adults in our society have a difficult time looking at those people. And that's what they most object to, but nobody looks at them. They feel invisible. And at least that's something that we can do, is to welcome them to society by looking at them and their families. Autism is one of the most devastating of the disabilities. Fortunately, there are not very many in our society on a scale of disabilities, but it is very, very difficult for families. It's a lack of interaction. Children refuse to interact, do not interact. They can be brilliant, they can be smart, but they don't talk with you, they don't look at you, they don't look at you. And I guess I will always remember, and maybe you will too, Linda, right? At the dinner table when I got a call from a parent who said, whose little boy was about 4 and a half and had been with us 1.5 years, and she called crying. Now, parents don't usually call me at home. And I always said, what's wrong? And she said, he kissed me. 4 and a half, the first time in her life that she had had a kiss from her younger son. I don't know who her support system was. She was foreign-born, had not lived in our city, but I don't think she had a support system. And when I think back on it, what a terrible load for her and her husband to bear for 4 and a half years with a child who would not let you love him, would not put his arms around you, would not talk with you, who rejected you. That's a very, very tough one. And they're not very curable, but the parents need to. If you know somebody who has that sort of situation, that's the kind of support that is so badly needed. Children with hearing impairments, they're also something that doesn't go away. It has its effect upon families because of the lack of good interaction. Parents, if the child is hearing impaired rather than deaf, parents frequently have fractured that relationship by scolding kids for not doing what they want them to do, and the problem was the fact that the child didn't hear. You get into the expense of hearing aids, into the child's feeling of being different when they get older, especially as teenagers if they're wearing hearing aids, of the problem of constantly having that on the agenda to keep up, of the special educations, of the need maybe to learn sign language, of the need to always be sure you're facing the child if you want the child to pay attention to you, all of the kinds of extra things about child care that go into being assured that the interaction occurs between you and that family. Then as children grow older, there are things like learning disabilities which make the child different. A child who doesn't fit with peers in the neighborhood in learning styles, you may have to go into a resource room, and yet will play with the children in the neighborhood perfectly well. There's just a little difference. The child feels it, the parents feel it, and also then you get into the child who is developing slowly, who is not a severely retarded child, but who is a slow learner. And parents, especially if this is a first child, may not notice anything different. They joy in their child until they go to a family reunion. And the other children, other cousins who had a child about that time, the children play together, and there's a little difference. And you come to that reunion 2 years later, and the difference is more marked. And you go back to that reunion the next year. depends on what kind of support system you have and where, how the healing has gone in your family in that situation. So these are, I guess that this, I want to say that no matter how much has been discovered in the past 20, 25 years to help children, we have not done a very good job about helping parents. Last evening we talked about how recently you've even been cognizant about the fact that there are special education and there are clinics and there are medical and there are research being done to assist these children, but not much yet for parents. And we don't have enough of them in our communities, or they're just becoming, I'm going to say, visible to us, so that those of us who don't have handicapped children in our families or in our neighborhood, we are not very comfortable with them, simply because we don't understand them, we haven't seen them, and we don't know what to do. And that's what this is all about, is to say, what do we know about these children, and what are some of the things that families are experiencing? And I've gone just through a few very brief kinds of examples. I'll give you some more examples. But let me first of all say there are a number of things which we can identify that families are experiencing. Let me just think. It's grief. With all of the denial and anger and all of those things that are in the grieving process, it's not something that goes away, and anybody who's done what we call grief work will say, well, you know, pretty soon you get better. But if you have a child that's always there, always reminded, doesn't get better very fast. You learn to cope, I guess that's true. But there's the anger, there's the guilt. For some, that's another whole dimension that needs to be dealt with. And I recommend counselors, professional people to do that kind of counseling. There are always lots of questions, not only the why me questions, the why us, but what do I do, where do I go, this program or this program, the medical profession, a counselor, family health clinics, the hospital clinic, the school clinic, all of those kinds of questions about where is there help available, indecisions about which one, the doctor says this one, my mother says this one, the neighbor says this one, too much help. And then when the decisions are made, you know, was it the right decision? If the decision was equally good or equally bad, you don't know. Hard decisions are made, and when the decision is made, the kind of support that says, was it the right decision? What I'm trying to say is lots of different kinds of help and support needed. Let me give you a couple of really true examples just to help you know what things are. Several years ago, I participated in what we call an interdisciplinary seminar at the university where I have been associated. We would ask some of the families who came to the clinic for a complete diagnosis, which usually took 2 or 3 days, where they see the physician and the social worker and the nutritionist and the dentist and the speech pathologist and the audiologist and all the people that they had come to see. We'd ask these families if they would be willing to be videotaped for the sake of training the graduate students and interns from the other disciplines. And some families were willing to do that. And I remember sitting with the social worker viewing a videotape of a mother as she was telling about, well, through her 2 and 3 days of conferences, telling about a difficult birth, telling about the child's medical problems, telling about when they discovered the hearing loss, telling about the behavior problems, sitting there just smiling. And I finally said to Jim, I know what's wrong with these tapes. She's smiling all the time. What's wrong with this woman? In the privacy of our little conference. And he says, Jane, it's called, if I don't smile, I'll cry and I won't be able to stop. And that's what happens sometimes when you see people on the street or in the store. How are things? Everything's just fine. And maybe it's been true in your congregation as it has been in our congregation that everything's just fine except when you come to church and then you can cry. Something about the community. So I thought it was just fine, but that's important that comfort level is reached. the person. Some don't feel comfortable enough to say, but it's really not okay. I'm still having pain about this whole situation. Grief takes many forms. Sometimes it's tears. Sometimes it's a complete withdrawal from those of you who would like to be supported. In your neighborhood, you may not see the person. They may duck, not face you. In the congregation, they may not come. Or they may go to another church. That's an indication of pain. That's a stage. You need to recognize it. It's not for everybody to intrude upon, but you ought to be concerned about it. To see that somehow there is a support system or a help. There is a denial. I'll tell you a true story. A woman brought up, it's both anger and denial, brought a little girl to our school to enroll her in a communication classroom. It's one of the programs that I was working with. Because she didn't talk as well as she should. She brought her when she was about 3 1/2, close to 4. And we have observation booths along the side of the room. The mother would sit in the observation booth day after day after day, watching what was going on. And I frequently go in and talk with her. You know, for 1 1/2 years, she never smiled. Never smiled. Got to be the sort of thing that everybody noticed. Mrs. Smith never smiles. Frowning. The little girl did very well in school. And she always wanted to know how she was doing, and she was doing well. And then it was time for the child to leave our program and to go into another kindergarten program in her own district, which was some 30 miles away. The mother had, look at the time, child with a problem, 30 miles through heavy traffic, to the school, 30 miles home, 5 days a week, 12 months a year. That's stress too, you know, especially with other children at home. Just the time is a stress factor. And we had a final conference about Helen. And I had to play the heavy because I knew the symptoms and I knew the child had done very well. But I also knew she wasn't out of the woods and that she had those early warnings that we talked about yesterday. A child who was going to be a learning disabled child, who was not going to be able to read well in school, who was going to have the kind of baggage and emotional trauma that goes with that. And I told the mother that I hoped that she was doing well, but that she really should be watched when she was the end of third grade or the beginning of the fourth grade, because it was very likely that at that time, when she got into abstract thinking and out of the concretes, the way that schooling system was, that she would be having problems at school. I remember the flare of anger. Just, you lie! And being just inundated with all of the anger that had been building up. And that wasn't true, and it would never happen. And the only thing I could say is, I hope with all my heart that you are right, and that I am wrong. Nothing would please me more than that it would be this way. Goodbye. 4 years later, I got a phone call. Mrs. Smith says, do you remember me? Do I remember Mrs. Smith? Of course I remember you. How are things? Well, you are right. She says, you know, when I left you 4 years ago, I cried for 2 or 3 weeks every day. Where's her support system? And I vowed this would never happen to Helen. And I found a private school and I went to work so we could pay for this private school. And she had all this extra help and individual work. And she is at the end of the third grade going into the fourth grade. And she's having terrible problems reading. And I want you to come to a hearing because I am suing the school district. Well, that anger was still there, wasn't it? And it had been simmering a long time. She's a Lutheran. The child went to private Lutheran kindergarten. I don't know what happened. I'm terribly upset about that. that nobody, especially in my church, saw the handwriting on the wall. It's a long time ago. We didn't know all that much then. But she knows, this woman knows, that she is going to have to cope with this. And now I find out, 4 years, when we can finally talk, and she can cry on my shoulder, that she is a learning disabled woman herself. And she has, in addition to this, anger, guilt. And is it inherited of the Christians? So you see what happens? And where's the support system? I don't expect that she let anybody in on that. I don't know how you get in on that to be helpful. But there's a lot of pain. And that's not an isolated incident. Yeah, and it sounds like the Parade of Horribles. It's kind of heavy today, but I think we need to recognize what's going on in our society and think about all these kinds of things that are happening in families where on the surface it appears that everything is going on just fine. And to ask ourselves, is there anything we can do? Where are you? Where am I in this whole scenario of people in the neighborhood, people in the congregation, people in the church, people in our families, cousin's cousin? What can you think about to do? What can you think about that needs to be done? It's going to the other side, I think. How about it? We're a small group. There's lots of hope, you know. Has it sounded like there's no hope?
There's, I recall having several acquaintances in families where they had Down syndrome children. Mm-hmm. And through our previous experiences, we had a neighbor. I had a baby shower for her and everything. And then a phone call came that they had this baby. And so we went up to visit them, and I had to say, excuse me.
That's all right.
I just got the 4 tears in my eyes in some people's. But he says, you know, God chooses his parents. We're with people too. Because he said they have a special ability that other parents don't have. And I remember this couple. They had both been married before. He had 2 boys and she had 2 girls and so forth and so on. They were so thrilled to have little Maddie. And of course they thought the end of the world was there for them. She frequently wrote us when we were in Hong Kong. She says, I didn't know what you were talking about, that we would stay for every young with a Down syndrome child. Because a Down syndrome child is very happy most of the time, but they need to be gorgeous and it's belly button sometimes too. And that's when they have to arise for the occasion. Well, when we would see them, she contacted, and I guess it was fortunate, maybe other places don't have it as much as in Chicago, but they have parents groups, and these parents get together. And immediately she had someone call at her door and say, look, we can pick him up as little as he was and take him to this training with her. And she did all these things and got together with other people. And then she in turn would watch for Down syndrome babies and help them through this. But I do think that God does give them a special insight. Walt's wife's mother and father celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary. And they still have a quote youngster in their house. Mm-hmm. And that was, she is quite young. I mean, she's old. But God has let those parents live that long to take care of her, and they have done all that they can to train her to be very self-sufficient.
That is true for some people. For some people, that message is acceptable. And for some people, they get angry at God.
Right.
So you have to be very careful about saying God has selected you or permitted this because you are special. And I just want to say that because that's not always, not every family would accept it. But I do want to also say that almost every large city and many small cities have support groups for parents of Down syndrome children, and they will come to the hospital, they will get you involved with support groups. I think the other thing that, now there's a very positive thing about you keep forever young. The other thing is the amount of, you get involved in early intervention schooling, the amount of extra work it takes at home is a lot of extra work. And I have recalled parents who have not gone out together for years, you know, not even gone out for lunch. That sort of dedication that says you give up yourself, and that comes to be resented pretty soon. So we support groups, yes, but in addition to the support group, because those support groups are almost disciples, you know, and I mean that kindly. Somebody else can say, how about time for yourself? Because the world will tend to revolve around the care. That's what that parent support group is, to say, no matter how much time it takes, we will give it. And there's another life to lead as well. And that's why some of those families break up, because that other dimension in life has not been cared for. So we can be helpful in, there is also, in addition to support groups like this, I mean, given that special sitters groups. If you don't have one in your neighborhood, or I mean in your area, you might want to think of Campfire Girls or Girl Scouts. There are instructions for special sitters. There are manuals, and sometimes hospitals have them, where children who are beginning to be of the age for babysitters can take special sitter training, and they learn how to manage catheters and wheelchairs and how to diaper older children and how to be trained to take care of children with handicaps who are older. Even in babies. So that parents and families have a chance to get away now and then. That is a wonderful relief. And the parents that I know have just had nothing but praise to say about that. There are also respite care groups that are available. And we've gone to the relieving the parents now and giving them some time off, and that's also part of the whole picture. Frequently available through colleges and universities, and if they aren't, they should be, or through hospitals, or could be through congregation or mental health groups, where families or young adults are willing to take a child with special needs for a weekend, so that a mother, and they're frequently single mothers, or a family, can have some time without that constant care, like 24 hours a day care, for a couple of days. That's special training. It should be available, I think, in communities, so that families they pay for it. I mean, you want to pay for your babysitting, and you want to pay for your weekend trip away. And so this is the kind of training that enables parents to feel good about, to feel safe about leaving a child so that they can do some of the things that sometimes you cannot do.
How about support groups for other children in the family? I mean, there are several instances I know where there's real resentment toward that handicapped child, so much attention is centered on it, that they hate it. They hate that child for a long time. I mean, there's also a period of loving that child a lot.
Right.
There are many that really resent all that time spent with them. There are no come.
That,
well, they need support too, but where do
good,
you get that?
Good point. There are frequently not very many support systems unless you think about that and develop one. That kind of support system is a citywide support system or a countywide support system. Family health centers, mental health centers sometimes will pick up that kind of family support. Social work departments sometimes will pick up that kind of family support. There is a recent publication, I like it, called SIBS of Special Kids. There are some publications for it, which would be a resource book around which you could. One of the groups that research group, the unit where I worked, started out with a program for fathers, teaching fathers only on Saturday mornings, brought their handicapped infants, learned how to take care of the kids, gave mother day off, learned how to take care of the kids, how to play games with the children, and were a father support group. And that then developed to a SIB support group. And that's how I know about this. Because the children came learned to interact with not only their brothers and sisters, but other kids, and then had a chance to talk about how they really felt about it. To come to grips with that. And so it's not only just, it's a family counseling unit is what it is. And the reason I say it should be citywide is because I think that it gets too close to home if it's a too small group. You need some diversity. We had a beginning in Seattle last fall. In fact, the young lady who's teaching at Narnia says, "That's where I saw you." in the King County, Pierce County area, some congregation, a couple of people in the congregation who were interested in helping children with handicaps, a woman with a handicapped child and a pastor was supportive, said, "We want to get people together to talk about support systems in church, what you can do in Sunday schools, what kind of support we need." And they manned, I guess they went to PLU to get some publication, lists of addresses. They went to the LIGHT program, whatever kind of program you can go through. And they scheduled a day-long session from 8:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon, brought in a few people to be resource people, invited parents, invited Sunday school teachers, invited pastors, invited anybody from congregations who wanted to come to talk about a variety of these kinds of issues. The hope was that from that there would be enough interest to generate either cluster groups, but that's a way to start. To see what the interest is, what the need is. And that's what this sort of session at Holden is all about. I mean, maybe sometime, 4 years down the pike, you'll come up against this kind of a need and say, "Oh, one could do that by talking to somebody who else in some congregation or mental health group or family services group or interdisciplinary clinic or hospital group or see all of these places where there are people who might be interested." The people, the discipline most interested in this kind of work is the discipline of social work. They are trained to do a good job. Sometimes those of us who are well-meaning don't have what I call tough love. We say, "Oh, that's going to be all right," and you know what, it's not going to be all right. And we kind of don't do what's needful at that time. So that kind of a discipline. And the other thing is, university settings have social workers in places that we don't know about. A contact to the social work department of a university, or to, we'll say, "Where do you have somebody who has skills in our neighborhood?" Might be another way to go. Other ideas about where you might go for that? Good idea. We don't want to forget the kids. They're part of that family. Don't forget the grandparents. You know, that's the hurt that's distant. Grandparents who don't have the day-by-day care, don't know what's going on, feel the pain, don't get in on the conferences, on the training sessions, don't do the same things as parents, and they will. We have grandparent groups in the program which I'm in, and that's the group that one of the groups I most enjoy talking with, because grandparents have time. And they have intent, and they have the kind of love that lets them parent and grandparent without having to teach. Too often, parents of handicapped children get co-opted into a lot of teaching, and are not permitted to parent. Can I make that difference to you? Teach this at home, and I have very strong feelings about what you should be asked to do and not to at home. And part of it is parent. Love, care, parent, be a parent. And lots of programs, they're very heavy on teaching. And parents get so involved in the doing that they don't have the lap time, the rock time, they become not relaxed with their children. And children need relaxation and that kind of time too. And parents frequently then, especially in the early years, are not able to give it. Part because of their own, what's going on inside of them. And so children need relaxants, grandparents, some of those kind of things. And there are grandparent groups that may be important for the child as well as for the parents.
Jane, you mentioned another problem earlier on. I wonder if you'd say a little bit more about it. Apparently, some parents have great difficulty reconciling themselves with the fact that they have a child with handicap. And the self-denial that you described is a problem. Is that because there are not good discovery systems for handicap, or because there's no way of working with the parent to enable them to accept the reality of their situation, or perhaps both of them? Seems to me that's a difficult thing.
There are two things that I think about at the top of my head, and we'll keep asking questions, and I'll come with more about why parents have difficulty in accepting. First place, we haven't seen many handicapped children in our society for very long. So it is, I don't know what's going on. What's going to happen? We don't have a history of what happens to these children. Society does not have a history of acceptance. I think the biggest problem is, what's everybody else going to think? And the lack of information, the old sins of the fathers visit upon the children is so strong in our society that it is, what did they do? And we keep, even though we give lip service to the fact that that is not so, that is in the air about us, that sense of what did I do wrong, and the feeling about people in the neighborhood saying lack of acceptance and lack of, it's the estrangement from society, whether real or imagined, it is there. That's why the Down syndrome people have such a strong program. They support each other. The problem that I see with their mutual support system is they don't let the rest of us support. It's exclusive. And it's one of the few that is so strong, because it starts at birth and it continues forever. They go to congresses together, they vacation together, they do all things together, because they support each other. And the incidence of these other handicapping conditions is infrequent enough that there is not a major support system available. But I think part of it is the estrangement the society still feels. How comfortable any of us in going up to somebody in a wheelchair and talking to them? Somebody can talk with us. Are you comfortable? What's your comfort level? Do you pull up a chair and meet them at eye level, or do you still talk down to them? You know, that's just one of those things. So that's at least, and the other thing, Vern, I mean, that's one thing, and I think that's pervasive, that a sense of acceptance in society and accept, and the sense of something I did, the sin concept. And the other thing is, in fact, we don't know as much as we think we do. I'll be very frank about that. This is so new. The research is so new. The working together is so new. You know how long it takes to refine your research and get it published and then get it into action. We're only 25 years into this at best. And when people go to a clinic sometimes, and I've heard Dr. Holm, who knows more about mental retardation than anybody in this area, say to parents, we don't know what caused it, or we don't know what's going to happen down the line. And it's hard for parents to believe that, but it's really so. Sometimes we simply do not know yet. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, Dr. Holm called me and she said, Jane, do you remember this little boy, she gave me his name, who looked like this, that was in the program on da-da-da-da 18 years ago? And I says, yes, and she says, you know what? We have another one. That is like that small incidence of it. And does that make sense? Does that help to understand why maybe people, who are you going to go to for help? The other thing is, in today's society, there are not very many clinics organized to give ongoing care. People are still clinic shoppers. You go to the pediatrician, he sends you to the physical therapist, who sends you to the speech therapist, who sends you to the nurse, and they're not a cohesive group who work together. We do not have enough cohesive sort of clinic places where you can come to one place and get a story that everybody has worked on. And where we are with reference to the research today is there's so many new things popping up. And this program is right for this group of children, but this one doesn't fit, and this program is right for this group. And they are in conflict, are competing now for children. And that happens to be where it is in society today. And so what are parents supposed to believe? I think that all of those things are a part of simply the now situation, that we don't really know as much. We think we know more than we really do.
So what you're telling me is that someone with a two-year-old child might very well never have been informed by anyone who has any confidence in or his judgment about the child. This child is this kind of problem.
That's right. That's right.
And when somebody suggests the possibility of that, they tend to deny it.
Right. And I'm unfortunately, there is still a lot of denial in the medical profession. And I'm going to give them a bad time. They're still saying, in some places, because they don't want to stress the family, well, don't worry, the child will grow out of it. And that's, you know, that's just not, that's often not the case. And when I've challenged some of the pediatricians who come to our clinic on that and say, why is that still going on? And they will say it's because the doctors don't know what to do. And because we have not yet learned to work together with other disciplines, we are still in competition. And that's something we have yet to do and to work with. You had a question.
Well, I feel the reason the Down syndrome support groups are so strong is because there's some knowledge there that has, it's pretty well accepted and settled that this is it, and this is what the parents look forward to. Whereas many other parents, if a child is brain damaged or retarded, they're still hoping that perhaps the child will outgrow it, and they're still looking, as you said.
We have some longitudinal evidence with Downs about what's happening.
Yeah, parents have a hard time just throwing themselves into some support group and as though, well, this is it, this is settled, this is what we have to look forward to, and accepting that as their own, because in some ways that kind of cramps them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not allowed the space to dream and adventure a little bit, that maybe this isn't...
That's a part of the broken dream.
Yeah.
That is part of the denial, too, I think. Gertrude?
It's a long time since I've taught already, but I was in all fields of special ed. And then when the learning disability came in, that was when we were having a hard time with, the doctor said, you teach and let us take care of the other kids and not grandchildren. Well, it's come a long way since then, and there is cooperation now. But I want to know, where is education on this? You know, are they requiring that teachers take a course? This, is, I think, would be terribly important. All teachers must have this kind of a course, so they at least recognize the child. They maybe don't know what to do with it. To know in that room of 30 kids, do I have 3 kids in here who really need some special help, and how can I help them? And are parents getting it, even parents who are going to have their first baby, are they ever alerted to all these possibilities? You might get one. Here's where you can get some help. So we just don't let them go blind.
Look at all. Look at all the prospects that Gertrude is. She's talking. I think even about information brochures for parents in hospitals or prenatal care clinics. Public health nurses do an excellent job. They have the information. We get money to get it out. That could be done. education, schools of education, where there could be requirements that people in regular education take a course or two courses, one course about this. Look at all the ideas.
Well, in Minnesota, it is required.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, but...
In some colleges, or is it a state requirement?
I mean, even, you know, children are mainstream now as much as possible, special children.
And that's why regular ed teachers have to know what's going on.
This works fine in some classes, depending on the teacher. Some teachers just have, absolutely, they don't have the capacity or the patience to cope with this.
So we need to talk to administrators about assignments.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to get some closure on this today. We've been lots of ideas. I think we've come up with a lot of good ideas.
You know, one thing that I think about doctors, and forgive me if there's a medical doctor here, I think it'd be so helpful if they were a little bit more honest with themselves and patients and be willing to say, I don't know.
All right. That's an idea. Where can we go with that idea? Where can that... It's a good idea. What can you do about that idea?
Any of them come to your workshops?
Yes. I'm in a position that I can do that, but how about...
Right.
So that's for some of us to do.
I see.
But how about you? Is there any way that you can put that into action? Gertrude came up with a good idea from this session about something in the prenatal information, about information in the College of Education's. Is there anything you can do about that? And if you go back to graduate school, can you make this, or do you have an in the College of Education at all? Can you make this suggestion someplace?